Hello and welcome to today's podcast from the Video Journal of Neurology. We are an open access video journal sharing the latest news in neurology across all major disciplines. Our regular podcast will bring you exclusive insights from renowned experts on hot topics in their field. In this episode, our experts will be discussing how to improve clinical trial design for multiple sclerosis treatments. Doctors David Lee Bland, Mitzi Joy Williams, and Gavin Givinoni will outline methods of improving the efficiency, ethnic representation, and success of MS trials. Starting us off, David Lee Bland from unlearn.ai will talk on the challenges of testing MS treatments, the need to improve MS clinical trial efficiency, and how machine learning predictions can be used to achieve this.
Multiple sclerosis is the most common autoimmune disease affecting the central nervous system. Its clinical presentation is extremely heterogeneous, with the immune system damaging the myelin sheath of neurons at various sites throughout the body. While the disease worsens steadily over time for some patients, most patients experience these autoimmune attacks sporadically as part of relapses, followed by a full or partial recovery. This complex, irregular, and heterogeneous clinical manifestation of the disease makes it very challenging to accurately measure the effects of treatments in clinical trials. Now, the most straightforward approach to increase the power of a trial is to enroll more patients. But this is very costly and time-consuming. So to summarize, it would be desirable to be able to run clinical trials with reduced numbers of participants in order to increase efficiency, reduce costs, and enable more studies to be conducted in MS. In turn, patients would have the opportunity to participate in more clinical trials, so efficacious treatments for this population could be identified faster. So our approach reduces the number of patients required to enroll in a clinical trial while maintaining statistical power and preserving type 1 and type 2 error rates. A clinical trial design, known as a twintelligent RCT, follows regulatory guidance on incorporating covariates into an ANCOVA analysis. Namely, one should include baseline covariates that are predictive of a patient's outcome. The more predictive the covariate, the greater the power it contributes to a statistical analysis. What we do is we leverage machine learning and historical data to predict the patient's outcome from their baseline measurements. We call these predictions digital twins, and they form a near optimal covariate to explain away the variance of the outcomes, drastically increasing the power of the statistical analysis while preserving the type 1 error rate. Our aim is to build a model of MS progression which can predict the outcomes of in control populations specifically to support the primary and secondary analyses of clinical trials. And to support the many possible primary and secondary analyses, it's crucial that our model make comprehensive clinical predictions, including all the major endpoints, EDSS, functional scores, relapse events, etc. So fully comprehensive model. So we used the data from nearly 2,400 patients in the control arm of past clinical trials to train and validate a machine learning model which predicts the progression of MS. So these data include patients with the three primary subtypes of MS: relapse-remitting, secondary progressive, and primary progressive. What we did is we split the subjects in the data into two portions, so a training portion and a held-out validation portion. A machine learning model was trained on the subjects in the training portion. Once trained, the model was used to predict the outcomes for those subjects in the validation portion. These predictions are called digital twins, and we compare their accuracy against the actual outcomes. So it depends on the endpoint one is interested in, and also the population one is studying. So for example, for continuous endpoints, such as the change in EDSS or the relapse rate, the correlation between the digital twins predictions and the actual outcomes is on the order of 0.3. This is strong enough to provide real gains in efficiency to a clinical trial. For binary and time to event endpoints, such as confirmed like CDI or CDP, time to relapse or time to CDI, the AUC or C index of the predictions is a better measure of the accuracy than correlations, though it's measured on a different scale. And we found that the AUC or C index of the digital twins predictions for these endpoints tends to be on the order of 0.7, which is, again, strong enough to provide real gains in efficiency to a clinical trial. But let me step back and translate these numbers to actual efficiency gains. So using a held-out data set, we found that we were able to reduce the control arm size by approximately 20%. This depends, again, on the population being studied and the particular primary endpoint of interest, but we welcome the opportunity to evaluate the performance in cooperation with a partner in retrospective or prospective studies. Digital twins can be used in several ways to improve the efficiency of clinical trials. So stepping back to, say, the design stage, they can be used to simulate the outcomes for the control group across endpoints to aid in strategic decision-making, such as understanding the effects of inclusion or exclusion criteria, selecting cohorts or subgroups with specific types of progression, or to support sensitivity analyses. In early phase trials, David Walsh and his collaborators have shown that they can be incorporated into a Bayesian analysis to drastically reduce the control arm while maintaining power and suitably limiting type 1 errors. But most significantly, as I said before, digital twins can improve the efficiency of trials supporting regulatory decisions, reducing the required size of the control group while maintaining strict type 1 error rates. In this scenario, the patient-level predictions provided by the digital twins are entered into an ANCOVA model as a covariate, increasing the statistical power by explaining away the variance. We're ready to do that, and we want to enter into partnerships to use these in trials, both retrospective ones and prospective ones.
Next, Mitzi Joy Williams from Joy Life Wellness Group will outline the importance of ethnic diversity in MS clinical trials and suggest ways of increasing access to different populations.
Increasing diversity in research will really take a multi-pronged approach. I think the first thing is to recognize that when we talk about it, the language that we often use is participation. We say there's low participation or people don't want to participate in trials. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that it's important that we do address things like mistrust due to systemic racism, et cetera, that certain people groups, particularly Black people here in the U.S., have experienced. But I think that it's also important that we look at systemic parts that are played that may exclude certain people. So for instance, thinking about our inclusion and exclusion criteria, if we think about Hispanic, Latino, and Black populations, they may have a higher incidence of comorbidities. Are we making our criteria so strict that we're automatically excluding groups of people, right, that don't need to be excluded? Also thinking about where we conduct our trials and investing in research centers that may not necessarily be proven, so to speak, but where there may be people who have access to certain populations that need to be in the trials, or looking at researchers who are people of color who may help inform those questions. I think we also have to look at discrimination and bias within the system and see ways to address that so that people get access to care and access to information and knowledge about studies and where they're conducted. So there's a lot of ways to approach it, but I think that, working together with the clinician, scientists, with the patient community, the advocacy community, as well as our industry partners, will help all of us to conduct better trials and to make sure that everyone has access to cutting-edge medicine and care.
Finally, Gavin Givernoni from Queen Mary University of London will discuss the reasons for the failure of clinical trials investigating remyelination strategies and what improvements need to be made to the clinical trial protocol.
I mean, the holy grail is taking somebody who's got established MS and giving them a treatment to, recover their function. And it's based on the hypothesis that people with MS have demyelinated axons and you can repair those axons by remyelinating them. I think that's kind of naive because, people with more advanced disease, when they've lost their axons, you can't remyelinate them. So I suspect there's a sweet spot, and with the oposunumab Biogen trials, we thought we could select a population that was not too early, because if they're too early, you're not going to be able to see an outcome because they don't have disability. If they're too late, they've lost too many axons and they're beyond in redemption. They're going to focus on the sweet spot in the middle. So these would be people that are got damaged axons but have got sufficient recovery mechanisms in place. And so we did target that population, but one of the things we didn't do in that population was to use endogenous mechanisms to encourage the brain on the spinal cord to recover. So although these therapies are stimulating oligodendrocytes or oligodendrocyte precursors to make myelin, the real stimulus comes from exercise or rehabilitation. And I think the main lesson I'd like to go out to people is we as an MS community are going to have to add on rehabilitation, exercise to our trial protocols to promote the biological stimulus that results in recovery while the drug's on board to enhance recovery. So I think the first lesson is we need to go back to the basics and think about how the brain recovers function. And we need to learn lessons from stroke medicine and a spinal cord injury. I mean, there's no way a spinal cord injury expert would do a trial to promote recovery of function of the spinal cord after traumatic injury without including superimposed exercise or rehabilitation. So that's the first thing. The other thing is age. So I know we have some defined trials where we have certain age cutoffs. There's quite a clear drop-off with recovery, with ability to recover function as we get older. And that's not intractable. I mean, the biology of aging has now been unpacked. We kind of know that aging is linked to a biological program. So could we give therapies that rejuvenate, in other words, get rid of senescence and make these oligodendrocyte precursor oligodendrocytes youthful again, and so they will recover function? And I think going forward, we're going to have to use what we call rejuvenation therapy. So these are drugs, and the one that's been studied the best by Robin Franklin and his group in Cambridge is metformin. So this is a drug that's licensed for type 2 diabetes. It probably works by upregulating NRF2, which is the master transcription factor for cell survival, and it's redox sensitive, so it alters the biology of the cell, and it actually acts as a rejuvenation therapy. So when we go forward in trials, we're probably going to have to add on our remyelination therapies onto these rejuvenation therapies to overcome aging, and in addition to that, have exercise and rehabilitation to promote recovery. And also, we need to shift our focus away just from the limbs. I mean, most of our trials use the EDSS or a derivative of the EDSS, you know, and that's not the only thing that gets damaged in MS. You know, what about cognition? You know, what about vision? What about bladder bowel function? So there are lots of other things we have to incorporate into the outcome measure. And I suspect it's going to have to be personalized, you know, because not everybody's going to have damage that's repairable in every system. So obviously, somebody's predominant problem is visual, they should have a visual outcome. If somebody's predominant problem is bladder or bowel, they should have a bladder or bowel outcome. If someone's predominant problem is balance, we should have a balance outcome. Lower limb weakness, lower limb outcome. Upper limb, let's say right hand in coordination, we should have a primary outcome measure for hand function. So I think we're going to have to personalize, well, at least set, you know, have subcategories, and we should actually judge the therapy based on that particular component. It's no point in measuring the other components if they don't have disability. So there's lots to think about, and I think we have to go back to the drawing board. I think the biology is right. I don't think the therapies that have been tested are wrong. A lot of them have proof of concept behind them, showing you they do get into the central nervous system, they do promote remyelination, and they are real disease-modifying therapy contenders. I think what's letting us down is the trial design.
Those were all the updates we had for you today. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed listening to today's podcast, and if you found it useful, we would love if you could leave a review. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app, including Spotify, Apple, and Podbean. Finally, be sure to follow us on Twitter at VJ Neurology to join in the conversation, and visit VJNeurology.com for the latest updates in the field. Until next time.